general summary, a general overview, and one hopefully swift passage about what it is that we have been meeting, looking at, talking about for the time that we've been together, wanting to understand the genesis of love, what it means to be a human being partaking in the perpetual perfection that God's life is about. We can either live with the fear of being hurt by life in some way, so that we spend most of our time trying to protect ourselves accordingly. Or we can use our lives to discover that who we really are cannot be hurt, so that we live without fear as we are intended to do. Then as I was sitting here pondering that, I have two other thoughts to add to it. It is impossible to try and hold one's life together and to know that one is being held in God's hands at the same time. Said slightly differently, it is impossible to fear losing face and see God's face at the same time. There's so much for a man or a woman who is willing to go past what we would call the edge of thought, to move into this world inwardly, that each and every one of us, to some degree, feels the pull of. Because when a person starts to just lean in that direction, ponder what might happen if they were able to choose differently in the moment that they did, in instances such as that, that person can begin to throw away, and I want to use those two words, throw away. You have no idea how much you have to throw away, because you don't know how much has been stored. We're meant to live in God's hands. The truth is, without living in the hands of God, no human being can ever even come close to being what he or she was created to be. And without approximating what we have been intended to be in this life, if we miss that mark, then the best we can wind up being is half human. Half humans are tormented by their own half humanness. Because one part recognizes and realizes and longs to live in a world in which they do not compromise themselves or hurt others. And the other side of them is nothing but a constant struggle to hold together the life that they put together, that they don't want anything to mess with for fear of losing that which they are not happy with. But the problem is, and this is why there's so much to throw away, how terribly abused, how amusing, and that's part of its abuse, has become the whole idea of God's life, God's hands. How riddled with sentimentality that steals the vitality from the whole idea is the notion that an individual is intended to live in a world in which, even as he or she walks around and does what he or she does, intermingling, having fun, singing, eating, and in the midst of that, they are never outside of God's hands. And that's their freedom. Their freedom is the knowing of a certain order of relationship that cannot leave them. And when, as we're going to do now, we talk about this possibility of living in the hands of God's life. What does that mean? You are in the hands of God's life right now, wherever you are listening to me. Only you don't know it because you prefer to handle yourself. It isn't until a person gets weary of being their own handler You know, this is a little sidebar, maybe not in the world you grew up, but a lot of people grow up and their whole hope in life is to become so successful that they have to have a handler. Yeah, I need a manager. How many of you need a manager? I need a manager. Someone who will, you know, take care of the petty details of my life so that I can go about doing the things that really make me live large. Listen to me as best you can. You don't know that God's hands, that God's life handles everything, even what you're going to say. But that life evades us because we're so constantly trying to figure out what it is that we have to do about our discontentment in life. So many things that we have to do in order to maintain what we have made of ourselves through time, that we wind up being individuals who, by and large, as a rule, just unpleasant to be around, because we're always looking out to make sure that whoever's talking to us is using the right tones, and that only people we want around us are around us, and nobody else should dare enter the space that I have provided for myself in which there's this measure of safety. I mean, it just goes on and on. And I have three stories to tell you. And I want you to understand that each story I'm going to tell you is related to the story that follows it, and that the three stories together tell one greater story. And when we're done, we will understand what it is that we must do to have a life that is the true life of Genesis, the true life where love leads us, where we understand that God's hands is not a metaphor that one feels good about when they're talking with others standing on the steps of some church, synagogue, or temple. But rather it is an actuality that is the very fabric of one's life, even as you're listening to me. And the question is, what does it take to bring myself to be aware of this relationship that already exists as the heart of me? So, first story, let's take a deep breath. A young man, he opens his eyes and he finds himself someplace. Now, keep in mind, this is all a metaphor, all a story. One day, you opened your eyes. And by the way, does anybody remember the day they opened their eyes in this life? I'm serious. We don't. You cannot remember the day that you knew you were alive. You just were. Incidentally, as you do your interior work, the day will come when you will know that you have been given a new kind of life, and you will never mistake that. And it is that moment that you know why it is that you didn't know you were alive when you started. So the story is, he finds himself laying on a bed. He doesn't know where the heck he is. Have you ever found yourself on a bed and not know where the heck you are? That was in the 60s, huh? I always have to get a 60s joke in. And he opens his eyes and he looks around, and there's three or four people walking by the door, the little passageway. And he walks out, he says, "Where am I?" And they say, "You don't know?" He said, "No, I just can't. "Oh, you're one of the new ones." "Yeah, I guess I must be." He said, "You're in the house of many of us." "The house of many of us? What's that?" "It's where we work." "What do we work at?" "Whatever the master wants us to." "Oh, well, okay. Not a bad room. Got a little painting on the wall. What's for dinner?" Second most important question. "Ribs." That's an inside joke. Kind of go through the story quickly, because if I don't, I'll just never get to all the other stories and the whole point of the talk. He finds himself a slave in the house of many of us. And it's not the worst place to be, because he's got people that he knows there. There's some nice ladies. There's men that he can chat it up with. There's decent food served fairly regularly. The problem is that he never knows when the master of the house is going to come and either praise them for what they've done in that house or beat them. And he doesn't even know when that's going to take place, because sometimes he's thought he did a great job and he still get bought. He still get beaten. Have you ever done a great job and somebody didn't recognize it? Who's your master then? When you want the approval of people that don't give it to you because you feel you've excelled at something. And his life was a kind of strange, happy unhappiness, a kind of discontentment riddled with time to time moments of a certain satisfaction that he, you know, this is nice. There's a courtyard and they were allowed time to sit by the little bubbling fountain and have a glass of wine when it wasn't their time to be doing things that they really didn't want to do, but it was part of what it took to be in that house. Keep in mind, this is a metaphor for our lives. But his discontentment for some reason grew. And it was exacerbated, it was made worse, because from time to time he would go and he would stand on the edge of this cliff that overlooked this ocean that the house of many of us was near. And he would look out at the waters and he would have the most extraordinary longing that he couldn't explain to himself, other than he just thought, as they would sit and have their glass of wine and talk about how beautiful the ocean was and how nice it is to be able to sit and smell the breezes and all of that. But that wasn't it for him. And on top of that, from time to time when he'd be sitting in the courtyard having his glass of wine, he'd look over and there was an old steward there, an old man. He worked for the house of many of us. And he'd look over and he'd be picking up his glass, getting ready to take a swallow. And the old man would sit there just looking at him going, no, just shaking his head. And first he thought there was something wrong with the old man. Because if you went someplace and some old man, wherever you went, was looking at you, shaking his head like that, you would do one of two things, wouldn't you? First, you'd assume the old man's been an old man too long. But then one day you might think to yourself, because it keeps going on, maybe this old man wants to tell me something. But why doesn't he just come up and tell me? Why does he have to sit there and shake his head no like that? Drives me nuts. So one day, finally, our hero goes over and he says to the old man, look, you've been nodding your head no at me for as long as I've been in this house. What's the problem? The old man leaned forward and whispered. He said, look, you don't belong here. What do you mean I don't belong here? I don't know any other place. He said, yes, you do. Only you keep drinking that wine, and what you don't know is that the master of this house has drugged that wine, and it is keeping you from remembering something that you need to remember. Well, what's that? He said, years ago, the enemy of your father's house saw to it that you were kidnapped and you were brought overseas to this place. This is not your true home. The reason that you look out over there at the ocean is because you are the son of a great king. And son, may I tell you that you will only be happy when you stand on the ground of your true home again. And until then, you will always feel the discontentment that you do. He said, well, what? Because, you know, that sounded right somehow to him. How many of you have the feeling of being a stranger in a strange land? My mind just jumped to this. I used to tell my mother I was sure I was adopted. She loved that. And the young man, after a time, he stopped drinking some of that wine. And this is an important idea. He stopped swallowing his own ideology. He stopped imbibing in what it took to keep his life in place so that he could justify living where there were pleasures, but that were accentuated, punctuated by these painful beatings, meaning the thoughts, the negative thoughts and feelings that he had to endure. Finally went to the old man. He said, what am I supposed to do? He said, look, nothing can keep you in the house of many of us. Many of us. How come all the names back then had E's at the end? Have you ever noticed that? Every last name, Eus, Julius, Marcus, yada, yada, yada. He says, so what you have to do is you have to, you go find the house of We Are Oneus. Go find the house of We Are Oneus. It's down the road. Well, what will I find at the house of We Are Oneus? That which isn't at the house of many of us. It's an underground house. It's a house that is set up to give you what you need in order to return to your home of your Father. Make it there, everything else will be done for you. And that's what our young man did. Not without trial. Because he said near the end, he said, but look, things aren't that bad. Do you know how many promises the master of the house of many of us has made? I mean, he's told me that one day if I work hard, I'll be free. Yes or no? And the old man shook his head again. That's all they can do. And they say, wake up, man. Return to your real home where you are already free. Now, what we have to talk about is several things. First, just so that you have this idea in your mind, how many of you from time to time exhibit meanness? Raise your hands. All meanness is born of many of us. No, many of us, no meanness. Why? Because when one is multiple, when one has all of the different things that one looks at and is attached to and depends upon and hopes won't change, then every one of the moments that turns life, however it does, produces a new action that one part of us has to do in order to keep intact what that one part says is the whole. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever thought that your whole life depended on one person recognizing how wrong they were? Given a moment, absolutely. Have you ever thought to yourself, I hope you have, how incredible it is that I can spend a week, a year, a lifetime going over what someone did to me so that the whole of my life is orbiting this one terrible thing that someone did and I have no life except of considering everything else around me around that sun of that suffering that sits inside of me. That makes no sense when we look at it this way, does it? None. But when it's taking place, it is our lives, isn't it? So the question is then, how do we make the return journey? How do we make it back to the ground of our true birth, into the hands of God's life? How do we do that? Next story, take a deep breath. Because we have to set up certain things to make sure we're all on the same page and recognize what is true about ourselves. How many of you recognize in a small way you are a little bit afraid, being very polite at this moment, to acknowledge that there are parts of yourself that you just don't want to believe are there? Here's one of them. You'll love this. Once upon a time, there was a school that students attended that was it was a spiritual school, but it was centered around athletics. How many of you are glad you're here? Because, as is so true, this is how glorious the intelligence of God is. There isn't one thing that you can do that doesn't have the whole story in it. Not one. So the school, there was one group of people who were going to learn what they needed to learn by pole vaulting. How many of you want to be in that one? And so they gathered, and then the coach and the teacher, they sat there in the stands outside of the field where they would do eventually the vaulting they had to do. And first they went over all the basics, the things that one needed to know in order to make the leap over the bar, because that's what you do. Does anybody not know what pole vaulting is? Okay, good. It's where a man with a very long stick holds it over his shoulder. Who thinks of these things? runs as fast as he can, sticks a pointed end of a stick that he's running as fast as he can with, which means his mother never talked to him. Jams the sharp end into a hole in the ground, and then the pole bends, really bends, and it throws him over this bar where he lands hard. Sound good? So they cover the details, and after the details are covered, the teacher explains to them, all right, now look, this part, you go here, and I want you to rake the sand. You take care of the path leading up to where the vault goes in. You make sure the hole where the pole is inserted is clean. And after you're done with that, you change jobs so each and every one of you can learn something about what it takes to make a successful vault. And this goes on for a while, and finally the students start to grumble. Some of them are going out and they're actually practicing. They're doing it. Some of them start to grumble. And this is really important because this is pertinent to every aspiring student. Some of them start to grumble. You know, this is stupid. I mean, what am I going to learn by raking sand? And who the heck cares about the path being cleared on the way to where you put the pole in? And who the heck wants to polish a pole? I don't want to do anything. This is stupid. This doesn't work. This school's dumb. I'm out of here. And an observer, someone who's been in the stands all along watching this take place, who's there for a very specific purpose. Listen to me. There's something that lives inside of you that is there for a very specific purpose, and it will appear in the moment when it is needed. And it will always ask you to look at something. In this instance, the observer in the stand turns to this one student. He says, well, look, have you even tried yet to go out and clear the bar? Have you tried to do the vault? And the student looks and he says, yeah, right. You can get hurt doing that. Try it again. Yeah, right. You could get hurt doing that. Translation. I love the idea of letting go, of letting God be in my life, of me taking part in this broader light that lives and governs. I love that idea, but yeah, right. What if I let go and I get hurt? What if I don't fight back? What if I actually, instead of letting that moment where someone hurt me or did what they did, instead of attacking them, they'll hurt me forever. They'll run over me. They'll walk on me. And it is that part of us it is that part of us that fears being hurt again that ensures we will. And the reason it ensures that we will is because we never learn to make the leap. We never learn to make the leap. And what does it mean to make the leap? Listen to me. Because if I've said anything the whole time, this is as important as anything I'll say. Nothing is learned without leaping. Nothing. And what does it mean to leap? The real spiritual leap? The real spiritual leap is never into something that isn't preceded by a leap out of who and what you have been. I'll say it again. The real spiritual leap is never into something that isn't preceded by you leaping out of who and what you have been. What does that mean? It means the spiritual leap is not where you jump into something you've planned. The spiritual leap has nothing whatsoever to do with you figuring out in advance what'll happen should you act compassionately. The spiritual leap is always born out of the recognition in the moment that this life is giving us, that I'm being asked to move from who and what I have been. I'm being asked to let go of myself for the sake of a self that I cannot know until I've actually let go. And for the purpose of this talk, we're going to call that the leap into the presence moment. The leap into the presence moment. The leap into the presence of this life. The present moment is a word that describes what the mind attributes to a point between the past and the future. The fact is, no such thing exists apart from the way the mind has defined it. There is no self that exists in actuality outside of the present moment, because the present moment is the living presence that is at the ground of Genesis. I'll say it again. How many of you understand that idea? We think we're in the present moment, if we're even capable of coming back to ourselves at all. We talk about being present. But when we talk about being present, our mind has merely picked up an idea of what the present is. And by joining ourselves to this idea, we feel like we've accomplished something spiritual. We're not looking to join one part of our mind with another part of our mind for the purpose of arriving at something that makes us feel good about ourselves and confirms personality. We're interested in discovering that we already live in a presence. And that presence is what sustains us. Without that presence, there's nothing. I really mean that. I really do. I hope you see that one day. We're so full of hot air, it's scary. You think to yourself, I will this. I'm going to do that. Watch and see what happens here. And the most amazing thing is that we are capable, through an act of imagination, through an act of contemplating possibilities, to produce a certain result in this world. That's part of what it means to be a human. But were it not willed by God that that should take place, nothing can happen. Nothing. Nothing. Person thinks, well, I move my hand. Look, I'm doing it now. Are you saying that's God's will? Absolutely I am. And the way I can prove to you that nothing happens without God's will is you can wave your hand till the cows come home and nobody's coming. Don't you go through life like, hi. You can't, look, there are things that you can make happen in the world of matter. There are things that you can make happen in the world of matter. There's no question about it. It's part of your gift. But the biggest part of the gift is the discovery that those powers are limited to matter and cannot be invoked through spirituality until you understand that the way in which you actually succeed as a human being is to put yourself in the presence moment. Because then everything is handed to you. No matter whether it seems something is being taken away or whether it's being handed to you beyond measure that you could dream of, every last aspect of that is given to the person for the discovery of what this presence moment is. Now, let's talk about the presence moment. Third story. Take a deep breath. Once upon a time. Now, what happens when the speaker starts the talk with once upon a time? It means that we're going someplace mythical, someplace not of this earth, although fulfilling all the principles, therefore. Meaning a time when the speaker's imagination wants to draw you into seeing certain relationships. So once upon a time, five men, these five men incidentally represent the five senses. Once upon a time, five men, all brothers, were standing on the shore of a great bay fishing. No, they didn't have spinning rods. Sticks. I have to make certain adaptations as I'm going. And they're fishing, and they're catching, and they're fishing, and they're catching, but they're not catching very big fish. And one of the brothers says to his other brothers, hey, brother. Yeah, brother. Everything has its beginning. You know, I think we could catch bigger fish if we were in the middle of the bay. Hey, brother, good idea. How are we going to get there? We can't swim and fish at the same time. I know, but have you noticed from time to time out of the mouth of that great river, logs will float down, and maybe we could put some of these logs together and stand on it and fish. And the first boat was created. It's my story. They made the first boat. Why did they make the first boat? Because they wanted to reach the center of the bay to catch bigger fish. So finally they make their first boat and they get out there, the five brothers, and they're catching bigger fish. But there's a problem. being in the center of the bay. And the problem with being in the center of the bay is that they don't all get to fish at the same time. So they're starting to fight. And why don't they get to fish at the same time? Because at least three of them have to use little wooden oars, the first oars that were ever made, to keep the boat from being carried away by a current out to the end of the ocean or drawn to shore. Can't keep the boat in the center of the bay. So three have to paddle while two sit there and fish. Now, which one do you want to be? So a fight ensues. And they go home every night and they eat their fish, and three guys are unhappy and two are pretty darn pleased with themselves. And they start talking about the condition they're in. Look, this is a story with great spiritual meaning to it. They start talking about their condition. One of them says, why can't we figure out a way so that we don't have to work to keep ourselves there in the middle of the bay? Yeah, right. Like we can do something like that. That's why we've got oars. One of them says, I have an idea. Are you ahead of me?
Yeah.
What's your idea? Let's get a bunch of vines, tie them together, take a big rock, tie the vine to the rock, tie one end of the vine to the boat, drop the rock, and then we won't move. And the first anchor was invented. This happened. No, I mean, this really happened. Can you see this really happened? What do you think the first anchor was? Some great, you know... Now, some guy said, rock, vine. Necessity put together the vine and the rock and anchored the boat. Now, here's the point of this. The winds and the currents kept pushing their little vessel out of the place they needed to be. And the only way that they could remain in the place they needed to be in order to satisfy the intention they had, which was to nourish themselves from the waters, was to create something that would hold them by being anchored to one world that wasn't itself a part of the world of currents and winds. I'm trying to show you something rather subtle. By dropping the anchor, one attaches oneself to a world that is not acted upon or that is not influenced by all of the other things that take place in the world of the ocean. Follow me now? So what we're saying here is that in the story, these people found something that was not part of the tides of life. Not something part of the winds that come back and forth. In other words, they found a way to anchor themselves in a world that was not subject to opposing forces. The wind is a force coming this way. My wish to stay where I am is another force, isn't it? We, as human beings who want to live in God's hands, in that which is intelligent and bright and light, if you don't like the word God, we must find for ourselves such an anchor. What would that anchor be? What would it take for a human being to walk into his place of business and have the hurricane Murgatroyd. I wanted to pick a name that was nobody else's name because everybody gets bothered. Why'd you pick my name? Hurricane, here I walk into my place of business and Hurricane Murgatroyd has blown through. Yes or no right now? When a wind blows through your life, doesn't it take you with you? Of course it does. Thoughts, feelings, desires, all of these things shattered become part of the vicissitude that walks through and makes a person feel like a victim, that life has done something to them. I'm trying to show you, at least with the story, the possibility, because if it, by God, if it can be explained physically, I can assure you that it exists spiritually. that there is a possibility of a person anchoring himself, just as the five brothers did, in a world in which it doesn't matter whether the winds come or go, whether the tide recedes or goes back. It makes no difference, none of those things, because that person has found a way to anchor themselves in a completely different world. And that's what we're looking for. We're not trying to escape the life that we have. The life that we have is necessary. In fact, try to get this. It's very important. We wouldn't even think about or long to know an anchor if it weren't for the vicissitudes of this world. It is a gift. Every last thing that happens is intended to show you at once that you live in one world that is not intended to be the only world, because by the very fact that you feel... Look, how many of you think a jellyfish... I'm picking the worst creature I can think of. How many of you think a jellyfish gets bothered when the current carries it someplace? Be a jellyfish for a minute. It's fun. You know, he's just, this is great. It was born in the 60s. But we know when we're moved out of our heart by something that has no heart. We know it. And we also know, as men and women, that we are intended, without contrived behavior, to be able to listen to somebody who's sitting there and talking to us, to give our attention to someone for a reason not selfish. I mean, you fill in the blanks. The point is that when these winds come, when we find that taking place, it's an invitation to recognize that I must find, if I'm going to be true to myself, if I'm going to fulfill the purpose of my life, I'm going to have to find something within myself that I can be anchored to. And the question is, and it's needful of being explored, what on earth is it then that exists that would allow us in this world of changes to live from something that allows those changes, that itself is the ground of those changes, but that meets those changes from love, from the understanding that they are working for the good of what is right and true, as opposed to being something that is always fighting the current and therefore the same as the current. So here's what we're talking about. We need to look and understand through the world around us certain truths. One of them is this. You know, the moon waxes and wanes, doesn't it? We know that the tides of the ocean, they come in and they go out. We know that even though we may not see it fully, the seasons themselves, winter, spring, summer, fall, that they are part of this consistent movement where things are waxing and waning. Things are being fulfilled. Things are passing. There's no instant in life, including our own body. Breathing. Try to take a breath. That's a waxing and a waning. It is a filling and an emptying, isn't it? And if we look at life, we can see that in the grand scale of things, this extraordinary set of principles about that which there are always these greater and lesser cycles fulfilling, receiving, releasing, receiving, releasing. Everything is doing that. And importantly enough, all of those activities, receiving, releasing, emptying, filling, they are all themselves complementary to one another. They're not in a fight with each other. Can you imagine if here comes spring and winter goes, not a chance, which is what happens in northern parts of the world. Not a chance. I'm not letting you in. What is the authority of spring? You know what the authority of spring is? It's the sister of winter. It's one relationship divided into four seasons. It's one life divided into what seems to be opposing forces. but they are not opposing forces. They are forces that work together for the goodness of something that can't be seen as long as we take one side or another of those opposing forces. Which is why he who resists always winds up being ruined. We're not meant to resist life. We're meant to embrace it based on an understanding that the life we're being given is being revealed to us for the purpose of helping us to discover ourself, our self in God, our true nature. So, yes or no, you can understand that this movement over here is really the same as this movement over here. Everybody understand that idea? That the receiving and the releasing, the emptying and the filling, though they seem to be separate things, they are really one thing. How many of you have that idea? It's important. Because what we're talking about is that when we look at these cycles like this, and it seems to be separate, we can understand with our minds. We can't see it with our eyes because it belongs to a spiritual principle. It belongs to something not visible to human eyes or the senses. And what belongs that we can't see, that we need to see, is that these movements, these opposing forces, must come out of something that itself contains these moving forces. This was a leap. Can you make it with me? Something holds that which we see as being separate. But again, I can't see it with my eyes. I only see the wind come. I see it move my boat. I don't understand that whatever moves me this way, that the opposing force exists and is in balance with it that way, which incidentally is justice. Throwing in a little deeper idea quickly here. You know why you can't escape yourself? Because the universe is built so that you have to see yourself. It doesn't matter how long you try not to look. You will never escape what it is that you are until what you are is changed into something that understands you never needed to escape what you are. So, moving along. Got this idea. Here is something that is greater that holds all of these opposing forces, but that is invisible to us. Now, take a nice deep breath. Yes or no? With our minds, with that same part that can see the whole of something, how many of us understand, even though we're afraid of the word, that the word, the whole idea of the end, is an illusion? Yes or no? I wonder if you can see it. Some of us are so afraid of the end, we can't even say it. Obviously, the end is an illusion. Somebody show me something that ends. You can't show me something that ends without me being able to show you where something has begun. It's impossible. The whole idea of the end, which, by the way, is very important to human beings, because what else can they do with their lives other than fear it? Plans, make ways to protect oneself from what one thinks is the end of something. There's no such thing as the end. Physics proves this, even if you don't understand it spiritually. And that must be also true, take a deep breath, if the end is an illusion, the whole idea of an end is an illusion, so is the whole idea of a beginning. Show me the beginning of something. I'll show you the end of something. Why am I saying this to you? I can actually see some of you. Relax your faces. Relax your faces. In love with a capital L, in true Genesis, beginning and end are one thing. Nothing is beginning that something isn't ending. Nothing is ending that something is beginning. And nothing reaches the point. Now listen, this is important. Nothing reaches what we would call possessable. See, we're possessors. You know the story of the steward in the New Testament? He thought he owned the vineyard. If you don't read it, it's worth reading. We're possessors. I own this. My thought makes for me the things that I need to have so that I can possess those things and exist as someone who has them. Then I can worry that you're going to take what I've imagined into existence, and then I'll imagine a relationship with you as my adversary. Then I'll imagine a bomb. No ending, no beginning. Now listen closely. What we call the end or beginning of something, and I'm going to show it to you if you're willing with me to look at this, is really just the moment in which, because of a certain stirring that has taken place, we become conscious of something that's happened. Life, look, does a river, can anybody show me the beginning of the river apart from physically speaking? I know, yada yada, it comes out of the water. But here you are, you're standing in a river. Show me the middle of the beginning of the river. Show me the end of the river. Can't do it. Why? It's just flowing. It's just this movement. Life is this genesis. Life is this genesis. It's just there because God wills it, because life makes it so. Here I am, I'm in the middle of the river, and all are going to go, hey, you just started something. You just did that. Or you just ended that. What's happened is at the moment, my mind is simply registering an event that it has created. Take a deep breath because you have to understand this. How many of you understand that you, and from time to time, look out and see something that you say is real that somebody else say, I don't even see what you're talking about. In other words, my mind makes of what your action is something that I can be angry about. Yes or no? There it is. That's the beginning. In other words, it starts at the moment that my mind forms an image of it and then knows itself through the image that it is formed. Same thing with the ending. Something's taking place and all of a sudden looks, oh my God, something's coming to an end. What's coming to an end? Well, this relationship is coming to an end. No, you just noticed at this moment that certain things have taken place in the whole of the movement, which doesn't begin or end, that you're identifying as being the end. But it is the end. It is. It's the beginning. Yeah, but I don't like the end. Please listen. Of course you don't like the end. Because you believe that who you are is connected to the story that now comes to a point where it's changing. The story is changing. And I'm not making excuses for abusive, inconsiderate, clout-like human beings who have the compassion of a toad when it comes to other beings. I'm simply saying that you and I need to recognize that all the time there are these things that are taking place that we name good and bad. You want to know the meaning of the idea of the fall relative to the knowledge of good and evil? The knowledge of good and evil is born out of a mind that is separate from the life of God, that names that which takes place according to its conditioning so that it can be a part of what it knows is good or what it says is bad. Because there's no compassion in that, there's no understanding in that, there's just a separate stance, separate from the life itself. Now, back to this. So what we call the beginning and the end is really just sort of our in and out experience. How many of you know you kind of go in and out? You ever been talking to somebody? You're talking to somebody and then, you know, 4 or 5 minutes later, they take your wallet? I mean, you go, what did you say? What were you talking about? I wasn't there. Where were you? Thinking about you? Listen. What is genuinely new does not have a beginning. We're talking about learning the possibility and the work that it will take to anchor ourselves. How? By cutting ourselves loose from thought. This ability that we have to anchor ourselves in the present moment is the act of a deliberate shift of one's consciousness. You could do it right now. You could deliberately take your sense of self outside of whatever it is that's being dreamed in your mind, and you can bring the whole of yourself into the presence moment, meaning into the moment in which you are conscious of the presence of all parts of yourself, including the room that you're in. It's actually natural for us. It's part of the new seeing that we talked about. And bringing oneself into this presence moment is an act of doing what? I'm denying myself. I'm taking away from myself the story that I'm in. You're always in a story. And I bring myself out of the story. Why? Because the story I am in, being matter, being thought, it's subject to the winds. It's subject to the opposing forces. In fact, if you want to know something deeper, there wouldn't be the opposing forces that cause us the pain there do if there weren't the story we were telling ourselves. Because what do these things hit? What does life interfere with? Good question. What does life interfere with? Does life interfere? Does anybody see life interfering with life outside these windows? Life doesn't interfere with life. I'll ask you something further. Have you ever walked outside? I really like this. Have you ever walked outside, walked up to a tree, and the tree said, "What's wrong with you?" Anybody here? Oh, if you have, we have help. Have you ever walked outside in a beautiful sunset, all these beautiful colors, and they go, "Why are you wearing that?" That's ludicrous, isn't it? Why is it ludicrous? Because what is observed is always new. It's always new. It's always fresh. It doesn't judge. It can't, because there's nothing in it to judge from. It is the exhibit of Genesis, that life that we see. It is absolutely free. Now, here's the question I'm leading to. If everything that we observe is already free, always fresh, why isn't the observer? I can't see anything in the universe that isn't new. Only the seer isn't. But that has to be a lie. There has to be something hidden in that truth, that the whole of life, God's life, every aspect of creation, from the highest to the lowest subparts, every last part new all the time, except for the one who wanders through it wondering what's happening to him. And when we understand, even in the smallest way, the possibility of being an individual who, instead of always being at odds with life, recognize that our true nature is itself no different than that life that it has been given for the purpose of recognizing this, then we can deliberately, and we must do this, I'm telling you, this will not happen by accident. We must begin to do the deliberate, every moment possible work of this shift of taking our attention and deliberately moving it away from the story of ourselves that has us not anchored but floating left and right, and hoping that the winds one day will balance themselves so that we can stay placed and feel good about ourselves. And it may, and you know the curse of it is that from time to time it happens. Have you ever noticed that? Nothing is worse than after a good time. I'll give you a minute to think about it. Why? Well, I thought I was anchored. There's only one anchor. In the world of passing time, there is only one anchor. And that one anchor is the world that gives rise to passing time. And that one world is God's life. That one world is our awareness of ourselves as being a part of this broader world that we can see with eyes not meant of flesh. Will one do it? It's up to you. But the whole of this talk, all of the series, leads to this idea that if we will make the leap, the deliberate leap into the presence moment, that means that we are leaving behind our story. We are leaving behind the genesis of self as this world has created it. Because that is one self, even though you may not understand it. There is one nature that has gone through a genesis since the beginning of created time for the purpose of remaining apart from this broader world. But yet, if we could see with eyes that see, we would understand that the whole of that is for the purpose of revealing the other world. Else, how would we know it? You'll have 10,000 opportunities just in the next day to make the leap into the presence moment. Find yourself getting worried, make the leap. Find someone saying something to you you don't like and you're going to start stewing over it, make the leap. Someone's tailgating you, pull over. That's making the leap, isn't it? Nobody's going to tailgate me. Make the leap, make the leap, make the leap. And what will happen, and I give you the word of truth on this. What will happen is that you make the leap and make the leap. The day will come when you will prefer to live anchored in God's life more than you prefer to be an individual chained to the endless struggle against the opposing forces that produce the world you presently call your own. You will only find this out by doing this. If you want to know whether or not there is God's hands, if you want to know whether or not a Genesis exists that never began and never ends, that is your true nature more than you can possibly know, you will have to take your life and you will have to exchange it. The leap is the exchange. Then, after you make this leap, you will discover, only after making it, that who and what you are cannot be hurt, because its true life is heaven itself. Make this discovery. It's up to you. No one can do it for you, and don't push other people. Leave people alone, as a matter of fact. Do your work, and God will give you the reward of that, which is a mind and a heart that is possessed by something true and that cannot be troubled.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation, visit guyfinley.org. That's GUYFINLEY.org. Receive helpful free gifts along with a host of life-changing information. That's guyfinley.org.